Tom Hudner is being interviewed by Renee Gerlich for an oral history of his participation in the Korean War, now celebrating its 40th anniversary since its beginning. Mr. Hudner is being interviewed at his home at 31 Allen Farm Lane on July 23, 1990. Mr. Hudner is 65 years old. The Korean War elicits neither the pride of World War II that spawned it, nor the passion of the Vietnam War. It has frequently been called the Forgotten War. It certainly has been part of your life in a very significant way.
Yes, it has been, Renee. I think particularly in the past 3 or 4 years when a group of Korean War veterans got together in their way remind the American people that there was, in effect, a war between World War II and Vietnam. I think this was brought about by one of the veterans who, while working with his daughter in preparing some history lessons, had her go to a local library to get some information about the war in which he had fought, and she came back and reported that there was almost nothing about the Korean War, but many, many volumes of both World War II and Vietnam. And he at that time vowed that he would make the American public as aware as he could that there was a very bitter and brutal war fought those 3 years from 1950 to 1953.
You are the only surviving Massachusetts recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor, of which there originally were 7. Can you describe your involvement that led to that particular engagement?
Well, in 1950, when the war started, I was in a fighter squadron that was home ported at Quonset Point, Rhode Island, which is just across Narragansett Bay from Newport. And in the summer of 1950, we were aboard the USS Leyte, an aircraft carrier, on a routine deployment to the Mediterranean, which was scheduled to last approximately 6 months from the time we left until the time we returned. And on the 25th of June, 1950, we got the information that the North Koreans had completely without warning attacked South Korea across the 38th parallel. And I have to say that most of us weren't even sure at that time where Korea was, because it's very, very rarely, if ever, mentioned during the war in the Pacific. But our carrier and our squadrons embarked on board, operated for about another month and a half before we got the word, at the time we were in Beirut, Lebanon, that we would come home and go through the Panama Canal to join our forces off the Korean coast. And we were selected because the numbers of carriers and other ships out in the Pacific Fleet were in such small numbers because there was really no thought that they would need a large navy at that time. And we were in a good status to go because we were in a phase of our training where we've been operating for almost 2 months since we left port, and we were in a pretty good state of training. So we did, we left Beirut, Lebanon, as I remember, on the 10th of August, and came back across the Mediterranean, back into Newport News, Virginia, spent 10 days down there, and we went down through the Panama Canal, up to San Diego, out to Hawaii, and out to Yokosuka, Japan, which is the Navy's main base out in the Far East. And then after 2 days there in Yokosuka, Japan, we went around to the Sea of Japan and started operating off Korea on the 10th of October. And when we got out there, this was less than a month after the now famous amphibious invasion, which was masterminded by General MacArthur.
At Incheon?
At Incheon, yes. From after the North Koreans had invaded South Korea, the South Koreans and the United States were so completely taken by surprise that they did not have the number of forces, and were those that they had trained nearly well enough to withstand the onslaught by the North Koreans. And the North Koreans quickly swept down the peninsula of South Korea until finally the Americans, now reinforced by troops brought over from Japan and other several other bases in the South Pacific, were able to set up a stronghold in the Pusan perimeter, which is the southeastern end of Korea. And they started moving slowly up north now with their new strength. But after the Incheon invasion, the 15th of September, our forces were able to cut the North Korean forces practically in half, which cut them off from their lines of supply and enable the South Korean forces and the United States and other United Nations forces to move quite steadily up north again. And so they had been on this move north for several weeks by the time we entered the combat area. As we flew our various missions every day, our forces were getting stronger and moving up to the north, and then there was a lot of talk about going all the way up to the Yalu River, which was the dividing line between North Korea and Manchuria. And we were moving almost without strong opposition, so that MacArthur was even making promises of having his American troops home by Christmas. As I remember, it was the latter part of October when some of our pilots made the first reports of seeing troops on the ground which did not appear to be North Koreans. Not that we could recognize them from their faces or anything, but from the way they were dressed and from the way their formations were spread out on the ground. This was the first knowledge that we had that there were, in effect, North Chinese troops on the ground. But we continued our advance. The Marines and elements of the United States 8th Army. There's a great deal of concern at this time back in Washington, both in the State Department and the military forces through the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that there might be the Chinese might come down in large numbers to try to stop our advance up to the north. But MacArthur put all of these arguments and warnings aside and continued to the north and seemed to completely disregard the warnings from Washington. Now, the problems that MacArthur was having with Washington, which was not only the State Department and the Department of Defense, but probably of most importance, President Truman, That's a different story and beyond the scope of what we're talking about this afternoon. The incident that you are asking about was on the 4th of December of 1950, when we sent a flight of 8 aircraft, as I remember, to conduct an armed reconnaissance mission in the vicinity of the Chosin Reservoir, which was, as I remember, probably about 100 miles north of the 38th parallel. We were going out there in support of the Marines, who by this time, and I should go back a little bit, it was on the evening of the 27th or the 28th of November that the Chinese finally showed themselves in great numbers, estimated anywhere from 115,000 to 150,000 troops who came down to surround our forces, which numbered approximately 15,000 total, both Army and Marine. And by sheer force of numbers, they were moving our troops very quickly back down to the south under just terrible conditions. It was ruggedly mountainous terrain up there, and the roads that they were using, that our troops were using to go north, were very narrow mountain roads, probably only wide enough for a truck to go by without any possibility of traffic passing one another in either direction. So the situation was quite desperate on the 4th of December when we started this flight. There are 8 aircraft in our flight, two flights of four aircraft, flying the armed reconnaissance, which meant we had rockets and napalm and a full load of 50 caliber ammunition. We were flying in the vicinity of the reservoir, probably about 5 to 10 miles north of the northernmost point of the Chosin Reservoir, when my wingman was apparently hit because he reported on the radio that he was losing power and was going to have to crash land.
His name?
His name was Ensign Jesse Brown, who happened to be the Navy's first black aviator. And although the area, for the most part, that we were flying over was heavily infested with trees, he was able to find a relatively clear spot to make the landing, make his landing. But when his aircraft hit the ground, it hit with such force that the fuselage broke. And at the cockpit, it was bent at about a 30 or 40 degree angle. And it hit with such force that we were convinced that Jesse was killed in the crash. We circled the crash site for a couple of minutes. One of our aircraft climbed a high altitude to radio to the south to try to contact a Marine helicopter squadron, see if they could send up a helicopter to try to rescue the pilot. While our that aircraft was up calling for help, Jesse opened the cockpit of his aircraft and waved to us to indicate that to us that he was alive, but for some reason he didn't get out of the airplane. In a short while, smoke began to come out from under the cowling of the aircraft, which really did bother us, because in spite of the fact that it was burning, although we couldn't see flame at all, we were concerned that if he didn't get out, that he could have been consumed by the fire that was probably going to result from what we saw. Well, we then got the word that the helicopter was, there was a helicopter definitely coming up to help Jesse. And after a while of my concern that the plane would burst into flame, I made the decision to make a crash landing next to his aircraft to pull him out of the cockpit and await the helicopter coming up. So after having made this decision, I dropped down a fairly low altitude and dropped my napalm and fired off my rockets and fired my guns into the ground to make the aircraft as light as I could. Made a slow approach, simulating a landing the first time to get a feel for it, and then second time with my wheels up and flaps down, using power, landed probably about 100 yards away from Jesse's aircraft. My airplane was reasonably undamaged, if you want to say that, although I knew from the first that it would be unflyable. But I went over to his aircraft, and incidentally the snow was about 10 to 12 inches deep, which in itself wasn't too deep, but it made it rather treacherous footing for us, because that snow was packed on the soles of my boots and later on the other pilot's boots, so that we had difficulty standing on the wing of Jesse's aircraft. The aircraft we were flying was a Corsair's F4Us. And for those who are familiar with them, they know that the wing extended down about 30 degrees from the fuselage for about 4 feet, and then bent upwards, giving the appearance of an inverted gull wing. And normal access into the aircraft was by stepping on that downward portion of the wing, and with snow packed on the soles of my boots, it was almost impossible to stand there without holding on with both hands to the edge of the cockpit. Jesse was trapped in the aircraft because where it had broken, his knee was pinned in so that he couldn't move at all.
Was he conscious?
And he was conscious when I got there. We spoke for a while. He spoke with some effort. Was very, very distinct in his speech, but he seemed to be suffering quite a bit of pain, which was, was not gasping or anything, except that he was speaking rather deliberately, you might say. And
he was exposed to the bitter cold.
The temperature was, my guess would be at that time, probably about 10 degrees above zero. And he had taken his gloves off, incidentally, to try to unbuckle the straps of his parachute, and dropped his gloves in the process, and his hands were frozen mm-hmm. solid when I got to the cockpit, when I got to him. But there's nothing I could do to help him out.
Do you remember any words that were exchanged between the two of you?
Well, not specifically, but in general, there was. I assured him that we would get him out of there, although I was very pessimistic about it. But I had to give him some words of consolation. I think he realized how desperate the situation was, but he was very calm through this whole thing, and. Matter of fact, he was so unbelievably calm under the circumstances that he gave me great strength and a determination to get him out of there. After I surveyed the situation initially, then I went back to the aircraft and my airplane, and the radio operated all right. So I asked the aircraft flying overhead to call back to the helicopter pilot to bring up a fire extinguisher and an axe, and hoping that I could extinguish whatever fire there was under the cowling. And an axe, for whatever reason, I don't know, it's the only thing that I could think of to try to cut away. And I think it was about a half an hour after that that the helicopter did arrive. The pilot had great difficulty in landing his helicopter in a place where he could feel comfortable that it would be safe, because he had learned that the brakes on his helicopter were not too reliable. The spot, incidentally, where the two aircraft had landed was on an upslope of probably about 20 degrees. And he had to find a level spot so that he wouldn't have to be too concerned about the aircraft rolling away, and which meant down the side of this mountain. So after he arrived, the helicopter pilot, who is a first lieutenant, his name was Charlie Ward, and we had brought him and nine other Marine pilots and six of those helicopters over from Norfolk, Virginia, to Japan. And I think we recognized each other as soon as we saw one another, although we hadn't at any time met each other on the ship. But he knew that it was one of our planes that was in help, because he recognized our call sign. And I knew from his call sign that he's one of those in the squadron that we brought around. But at any rate, Charlie and I worked for probably about half an hour trying to see if there's just any way we could free Jesse. And we're just unable to do so. And Jesse was talking less and less as time went on. And you can well imagine that the way the aircraft had was so badly damaged, it was very much of a surprise that he'd survived the crash at all. The day was getting well along, and although it wasn't getting dark, it was the sun was about to go down. And Charlie said that he had to get out of there because the helicopter could not fly his helicopter after dark in that mountainous terrain because he didn't have the instrumentation. So the two of us discussed the situation away from the aircraft, and it was decided that we were going to have to leave the area. But at some time, we weren't sure, we were quite sure that Jesse had passed away, because he seemed to be getting weaker in his talking. His periods of talking got to be farther and farther between. Periods of talking were less and less. I told Jesse that we're going to have to leave him for a while, and we're going to go down and get some more equipment to help him get out. And one thing he did say to me, he said, well, if anything does happen, make sure that I told his wife that he loved her. And he had, at the time, only a five-year-old daughter named Daisy. And we left him there. Those were his last words, but those were not his words as we left, because at the time we left, we had intention of coming back if we could find any equipment to help him out. So we made an uneventful flight back to a small landing strip at the foot of the reservoir called Hagaruri, where Marines were straggling in from across the reservoir and down the mountain beside it. And this was right in the middle of this withdrawal of roughly 15,000 troops, less those that had been killed during that period of time. We were not able to find any more equipment, and as darkness was just about on us, the helicopter couldn't go back up to the crash site. The only thing he could do then was to leave there, and the two of us went down to another small strip 15 miles to the south called Puerto Reed, where he and I spent that night, where during the night the temperature was about 25 to 30 degrees below zero. The next day we flew down to an airfield farther to the south, an airfield called Yanpo, which was near Ham Hung, one of the major seaports on the east coast of Korea, still in the north. And 3 days later, on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day, an aircraft came in from the ship to pick me up, fly me out to the ship. And when we got out there, the captain of the ship said that he was ready to take the carrier as close to offshore as he could, send a helicopter in with a flight surgeon, and go to the crash site and get Jesse's body out of the cockpit and bring it back for decent burial. But the decision finally was made that it was not worth the risk because of the possible enemy activity in that area. So the captain dispatched several aircraft to go back there with napalm. We found the crash site and dropped napalm on the aircraft and the body to cremate it. And
had the body been noticeably clothing removed,
yes,
or military gear?
Yes. The body was still in the cockpit, and the clothing had been taken from the body, which indicated that the soldiers or the peasants were so desperate for clothing that they took it off his body. So that was on the 7th of December. And,
in napalming it, there was a tribute, final tribute.
Yes, yes. There's, you might say, like a funeral pyre for a deceased warrior. The captain was very desirous of doing this so that his body wouldn't be just left out there to the wild animals or whatever there was. And it was, even though, of course, dead, it was the most humane thing that the captain could think of doing under those circumstances.
In honor of Jesse, there was a boat years later named for him?
Yes. There was a what we call a fast frigate. It was named after Jesse Brown, which is still in commission, is home ported down in South Carolina, Charleston. And it was interesting that on the day after Washington's birthday, February 23rd, 1973, the ship was in Boston for final commissioning. And Jesse's widow was invited up to be the sponsor of the ship, and I was invited to be there at the ceremony.
Very nice.
And since that time, Jesse Brown has been up to Boston a number of times, and that crew is very proud of Jesse, because of the person that he was.
What do you remember about him as an individual?
Well, Jesse was a very, very quiet, soft-spoken person who I think was very conscious of the responsibility he had as being as someone who had broken the racial barrier, which was very strong in all of the services, and particularly in the very strong tradition-bound Navy, where up until that time, blacks had very little opportunity to get very far in the Navy except in relatively servile positions. And although the Navy had had a few officers, no one had gotten into the flight program. And when he finally was selected for the program, it was extremely difficult for him because every place he went, he was faced with bigotry, people openly calling him names to his face. Even though he was not married at the time he started flight training, he did marry his childhood sweetheart, and when they were together, they were both embarrassed by some of the things that were said to them, which was apparently quite a popular sport in many parts of the country. And those of us who have never when he started flight training, Jesse was not married, but about, as I understand, probably about 6 or 7 months after he started, he did get married. He felt that he needed companionship that he definitely was not getting in that program. So he and Daisy were secretly married. Incidentally, I think I referred to his daughter as Daisy. His daughter was Pam, Pamela. And whenever they could get together, they did, and they had to do so secretly, because if he had been found out, he would have been thrown right out of the flight program, because students at that particular time were not allowed to be married while going through flight training. After he got his wings, then he was able to tell that he was married. But the Navy then was faced with the problem of where they could send a black pilot like this so that he could lead a reasonably normal life. And they ordered him to Quonset Point, which is, as I say, across Narragansett Bay from Newport. And it was one of the shames of our history that even up in New England, he was the two of them were subjected all the time to indignities and all sorts of problems in trying to find a decent place to live, trying to have things done. But they were very well received in our squadron and by everybody in our air group. And I think under the circumstances, particularly when people like them were virtually an oddity in our Navy, they were nevertheless accepted very warmly into our squadron, and I think that they felt very comfortable being with our squadron, and they mixed fairly well socially. His widow was invited up to be the sponsor of the ship, and I was invited to be there at the ceremony.
Very nice.
And since that time, Jesse Brown has been up to Boston a number of times, and that crew is very proud of Jesse because of the person that he was.
What do you remember about him as an individual?
Well, Jesse was a very, very quiet, soft-spoken person who I think was very conscious of the responsibility he had as being someone who had broken the racial barrier, which was very strong in all of the services, and particularly in the very strong tradition-bound Navy, where up until that time, blacks had very little opportunity to get very far in the Navy except in relatively servile positions. And although the Navy had a few officers, no one had gotten into the flight program, and when he finally was selected for the program, it was extremely difficult for him because every place he went, he was faced with bigotry, people openly calling him names to his face. Even though he was not married at the time he started flight training, he did marry his childhood sweetheart, and when they were together, they were both embarrassed by some of the things that were said to them, which was apparently quite a popular sport in many parts of the country. And those of us who've never when he started flight training, Jesse was not married, but about, as I understand, probably about 6 or 7 months after he started, he did get married. He felt that he needed companionship that he definitely was not getting in that program. So he and Daisy were secretly married. Incidentally, I think I referred to his daughter as Daisy. His daughter was Pam, Pamela. And whenever they could get together, they did, and they had to do so secretly, because if he had been found out, he would have been thrown right out of the flight program, because students at that particular time were not allowed to be married while going through flight training. After he got his wings, then he was able to tell that he was married. But the Navy then was faced with the problem of where they could send a black pilot like this so that he could lead a reasonably normal life. And they ordered him to Quonset Point, which is, I say, across Narragansett Bay from Newport. And it was one of the shames of our history that even up in New England, he was, the two of them were subjected all the time to indignities and all sorts of problems in trying to find a decent place to live, trying to have things done. But they were very well received in our squadron and by everybody in our air group. And I think under the circumstances, particularly when people like them were virtually an oddity in our Navy, they were nevertheless accepted very warmly into our squadron, and I think that they felt very comfortable being with our squadron. And they mixed fairly well socially. Jesse was a rather pretty laid back, very popular. He had a great sense of humor. And yet he was somebody who did not go out to make friends. He realized the situation he was in and never wanted to make the mistake of trying to force himself on somebody who resented his being there. So he made friends by having people come over to him to make the advance of being friendly to him, and which was a good approach, because I'd never heard of anybody who resented his being with us. He's probably one of the best examples of somebody who could be integrated into a completely white man's world.
Do you remember the circumstances and the day when you received the Congressional Medal of Honor from Truman?
Well, it was the day was Friday the 13th of April, 1951. And obviously I was very excited, as was my whole family. We were invited to go to Washington to be the guests of the Navy Department. And my mother's family from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which is probably about probably less than 100 miles away, we all gathered there with my family from home, Fall River, And some of my friends, both from Fall River and in the Washington area, were down at the White House. And it was a particularly significant experience for me at that time. This was only 2 days after President Truman had announced that he had fired General MacArthur. And this was the president's first public appearance since he made that announcement. So that when, at the time of the ceremony, which was in the Rose Garden outside the White House, there were over 100 reporters there. And I think the great majority of them were there just to be able to get a look at the president, try to get a statement from him, because he had just fired a very popular military general who had made quite a name for himself during World War II and, in effect, during World War I.
What was the sentiment among your squadron to the firing?
Well, most of us didn't know very much about General MacArthur, and we didn't really talk very much about it. The news came as quite a shock, because I don't think many of us were very we were at an age and at a time we didn't do an awful lot of reading and serious discussions about what was going on. But I think that, as I do remember, generally the sentiment was against the president having done that. Although, certainly when you read the history and find out what problems the president and the chiefs of staff, the joint chiefs of staff and the State Department and everybody else was concerned with, it's quite understandable that they couldn't continue to operate with military commander in the field doing whatever he wanted to do and making whatever statements he wanted to make, really in disobedience with what he was told to do from Washington.
How old were you then?
I was 26.
So the actual awarding of the medal was very thrilling.
Oh, yes. And that, this was the first award since World War II. Other actions took place in Korea prior to the 4th of December, but mine was the first one that the president actually presented subsequent to World War II. And I was told beforehand that, I don't remember who told me, maybe it was one of the reporters, but he said, as the president fixed the ribbon around my neck, he'd say, I'd rather have this than be president. And I sort of passed that off as probably an old wives' tale, but sure enough, that's what he did say at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very charming person. I have to say that my mother's family from Pennsylvania were almost rabid Republicans, and they commented several times beforehand that the only thing spoiling this whole thing was that it was wrote that Truman was going to put it on. But he charmed them to the point where he completely won them over, and they allowed us how it really wasn't too bad an experience after all, because he seemed to be a pretty good guy.
Were you the only recipient on that particular day?
Yes. Mm-hmm. There are a number of times later on that several were awarded at the same time, but I was alone at that time, yes.
Were you surprised when you first heard that you were awarded?
Well, I wasn't surprised when the word came from Washington. I was surprised back at the ship, because the word got around from somebody that I was written up for it. And there's a long chain in the chain of command. The citation first is written up by the senior officer on the scene who observed this, and then that would have to be endorsed by the commanding officer, and then you go up through his superior and then through his superior and all the way up until it finally gets to I don't remember at that time, but be the Secretary of the Navy, and then it had to even get further approval until it was it finally got through for approval to be awarded in the name of Congress. And I think it was about, as I remember, about 12 different levels that it had to go through, everyone approving it before it went all the way.
So you went from lieutenant to ultimately a captain?
Yes. At that time it was lieutenant junior grade, which is the equivalent of first lieutenant in the Army or the Marine Corps. And I retired from the Navy as a captain, yes.
So that became your career?
Yes.
Did you ever find that you are never away from this, that it's always with you?
Well, that, yes, that is so. The job that I have now is Deputy Commissioner of Veterans Services. Of course, the business I am in, when I'm associating all the time with veterans of the various services, the decoration is immediately recognizable. But there are times when, if I'm not in that particular area, I can be in many places in society where literally I could go for months and months and months, and either people don't know anything about it or they have absolutely no idea what the what the decoration is. So there's no involvement there, but it's obviously just like anything else, it doesn't mean anything unless you're with people who recognize what it is.
You said you were deputy commissioner, now you're acting commissioner.
No, that changed Friday.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I will probably say for the record, it wasn't too much of a surprise, but it was very definitely a political decision on the part of the governor, who...
this is Governor Michael Dukakis.
Governor Michael Dukakis had appointed me as deputy commissioner 2.5 years ago, in spite of the fact that I advised him I was a Republican, and he told me that my politics did not matter. But last Thursday, he made the decision that he was going to appoint somebody else to be commissioner because he could not have a Republican in that position.
Because of the upcoming election?
Primarily because of that. So that I will still be deputy commissioner until the new administration comes in sometime after the 1st of January.
The concept of veterans receiving benefits separately, could you comment on that?
All right, I am a deputy commissioner of Veterans Service for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and our office oversees the implementation of a program of providing benefits to Massachusetts veterans, who are veterans within a very narrow definition of the term. That is, a veteran has to have been in the service during a war, and subsequent to Korea, he actually has to have been in a combat area. In other words, just being a stateside veteran or in the service during stateside doesn't necessarily qualify him for these benefits. But if he has a financial need, this veteran, or bona fide dependents such as a spouse or children, or even dependent parents, or dependent adopted children, the state will see that these veterans will get financial assistance as necessary to enable them to live with some dignity. The program provides for medical care, as well as necessary living expenses, to pay for rent, heat, and food. And this is a program which exists all throughout the state. Every city and town in the Commonwealth has a veterans agent, and a number of these veterans agents represent two or more cities or towns. And it is they who make themselves available to the veterans, and under the supervision of our office, these veterans agents provide the veterans with the benefits to which they're entitled, according to some rather stringent guidelines. So there's very little arbitrary action taken by the veterans agents. They have to do all of this within a rather rigidly defined guidelines.
Well, both the Korean War and veterans are worth remembering. Thank you.
Yes.